Hello, I'm Claire Armitstead. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
When I was a child, I would just hate my family. I would hate them very, very deeply, you know. I would hate my father for telling me, you are the shame of the family. My father was telling me, everybody is mocking our family because you're effeminate, you know. And because of that, I hated them. And for me to write was to take another point of view on my childhood, to see it differently, and to excuse everything.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. This week we brave the thin divide between reality and make-believe in autofiction with France's very own cause célèbre. He is Edouard Louis. That was him speaking, and the person who had the privilege of meeting him this week is our very own Sean Kane. Sean, Edouard is very young, and he is French, and we, as we know, we're rubbish at translating in England, so why do you think he's so special?
Well, he's very special, and his book is very, very special. It's called The End of Eddie, and it's his first book. He was 21 when he wrote it, and it was an immediate sensation in France because it put a light on an entirely unexplored part of French life. He grew up in this post-industrial, poverty-stricken town in northern France. He knew he was gay from a very young age, and he was growing up in an environment where that really was not okay. He was dealing with all these ideas about gender and masculinity from a very young age. And as he grew up, he eventually wrote this book, and he didn't even read a book for the first time till he was 17. And this book came out of him, and it's so tender, and it's beautiful, and it's brutal, and it's very, very exciting.
Okay, well, let's meet him now. And a quick warning for those of sensitive dispositions, there is some challenging language in this podcast which may offend some listeners.
I think the first thing to address with this book, End of Eddie, for people who haven't read it yet, is how it blends a sort of novel-style narrative but with autobiographical fact. It's a book about a child called Eddie Bergel, who's born in rural northern France in 1992. And your own name, your original name, was Eddie Bergel as well.
Yeah.
And you were born in Picardy in 1992. So I suppose just for people that haven't read it yet, could you explain what the relationship is between Eddie in the book and yourself?
Yeah. So Eddie Bergel used to be the name... that my parents gave me when I was born. And you know, among the very poor people in France, they give American names to the kids. So I was Eddie, and my cousin was like Brian, Brandon, Jefferson, Candice, you know, all these things. And my name was Belle Girl, which means like pretty mug, which is a pretty face, but in a very like harsh slang. And so it was such a name of a tough guy, you know, because all the Belle Girl of the village were like very tough guys. My uncle, my grandfather went to jail, my cousin went to jail. And so there was kind of a reputation that came, you know, like before me. And the dream of my father was for me to fit in this name. He wanted kind of a tough boy to like reinforce his own masculinity, you know. Fathers make good boys in order to build the masculinity through the kids that they have. And when I was born, I failed immediately. It was immediately I failed. I was born like an effeminate kid with a high voice, with feminine manners. And my family didn't understand why it happened, you know. It was, so the book, The End of Eddie, is kind of an impossible meeting, an impossible relationship, an impossible love between me and my family, you know. Mm. Very early it was too late. It was immediately too late. And because, yeah, I didn't succeed in achieving what my father wanted me to to achieve.
In the book, Eddie, from a very young age, he's criticized by people around him, including his own parents, who say things like, you know, stop your fancy ways and stop the queenie gestures and that sort of thing. Are they things that you heard as a child yourself?
Yeah, like 5 times per day. Because, you know, the novel is, on the one hand, a portrait of Eddie, of this kid, of this different child. And on the other hand, is the portrait of the milieu where I was born. So, you know, it was a small village that I describe in the end of Eddie, a small village in the north of France, where like 30 years ago, there was a factory and all the men, because it was mostly the men, would work at the factory. And one day the factory closed and everybody was hopeless and jobless and very poor. And I was born in this village where people were living through misery, through very big difficulties, through big like economical problems, lack of money. And of course, all these people were expelled, excluded from school, excluded from cultural capital, excluded from going to the city because they were so far, because there were no station. The only thing that was left for them was the body. So the only thing that the society, that the system left them was the body. So of course, at the end, they would build an ideology of the body, of the strength, of the masculinity. And the masculinity shaped everything during my childhood. Mm. Everything. All the thing you would do was to be a real man, you know. All my family would vote for Marine Le Pen because she had balls, you know. Even the class issue was an issue of gender. To be a real man of the working class meant not to cross the leg like the men of the bourgeoisie do, you know. It meant not eating small plates that are very expensive like the bourgeoisie do, but to eat like real big food. So like the masculinity was everywhere. And Eddie and the kids that I was just it didn't work for him. It was not like this. It was the opposite of the masculinity. So it was very important for me, even if it's an autobiographical novel, to describe as precisely as possible this milieu where I grew up, because I wanted to give voice to these people. I wanted to give voice to to these groups that we never talk about.
I've read an interview with you where you said that books were not part of your household as a child, and your parents did not read, rarely if ever, and that often their argument about that was, well, these books are not for us, these books are not written for us, that there's no one like us in these books. And that sort of transfers itself to political discourse, where they'd say, well, all of these people are not for us, but Marine Le Pen, she talks about people like us, and that's why we're going to vote for her. Is that still the attitude in your family?
Oh, yeah. More than ever.
Yeah.
More than ever. When I was a kid, all my family would vote for Marine Le Pen for the Front National, and even like my father would bring my big brothers and big sisters in the little box when you vote, I don't know the English term, to check if they were voting for the Front National. And you know, it was a very small village, so my father was more or less friend with the mayors. They went to school together, so he didn't say anything. And of course, the fact that the people were voting for Marine Le Pen, it was because of this impression that they were like completely meaningless. They had this impression that they didn't count, that nobody was talking about them, that in the media, in the literature, and among the left-wing politicians were supposed to talk about them. You know, in France, we don't have the chance of having Jeremy Corbyn. We don't have people like this. And so the very poor people, they feel far from everything. And when I started to write The End of Eddie, that's what gave me anger. That's why I wanted to write this book, because I read the first book of my life at maybe 17 or 18, because before I wouldn't read books. My father would always say books are for pussies, you know, and it was an effeminate thing to read book. So even if like at some point of my life at 14 or 15, I did everything I could to be different from my family. I started to do everything to be different. It took a while to do it, but still I kept this like suspicion towards books till very late. But when I did, when I opened book, when I opened all the books that were published, I didn't see the world of my childhood. I didn't see these people. I didn't, and I understand why my mother say nobody talk about hers. It's terrible that she vote for the extreme right. But I understand the process, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think when you consider literature, you always have to ask yourself what literature excludes in order to be perceived as like legitimate literature, as real literature, as contemporary literature. Mm. For a long time, it was the black people, you know? And suddenly, Zora Neale Hurston or James Baldwin or Toni Morrison, they included by force black people into legitimate literature. Mm. And when I started to write, the condition of literature, the definition of literature was to exclude the people of my childhood, mm-hmm. was to exclude my father, was to exclude my mother. Mm-hmm. You did literature if you did that, if you don't talk about my mother. Mm-hmm. And that made me crazy. Mm-hmm. And that made me write.
Did you write this very quickly? Did you sort of write nonstop when
I
you were
wish.
Writing?
I know. No, it didn't. It didn't work this way, unfortunately. No, it took like, I needed 2 years and a half. Writing every day. I mean, that's maybe boring to say because everybody knows that writing is hard. But yeah, because I wanted to be fair. Mm. I wanted to be just. And this kind of balance was very difficult to find. Mm. Because when I was Eddie, when I was a child, I would just hate my family. I would hate them very, very deeply, you mm-hmm. know. I would hate my father for telling me, you are the shame of the family. My father was telling me, everybody is mocking our family because you're effeminate. And everybody say, oh, that's the family with the faggot, you know. Mm. And because of that, I hated them, you mm. know. And for me to write was to take another point of view on my childhood, to see it differently, and to excuse everything. Mm. And you know, when I'm talking about like how harsh it was to be gay in the village, I'm not complaining. Like I'm a happy person now. What makes me crazy today is to know that people are still enduring the same thing again and again. Mm. And that's why I wrote this book, you know. It's not about catharsis, it's about politics. Mm. It's about what we can do tomorrow. I want it to be clear. I don't want people to think, oh, look at him, he suffered. That's not the point. Mm. The point is, what are we going to do tomorrow and what are we going to do now?
One of the things that End of Eddie has been praised for so much is how it looks at anger and how it looks at shame, but it does it with a complete lack of self-pity. There's almost a detachment there, that there's certainly a lot of nuanced observation, but it does feel like you've been able to stand back and look at it from the outside. Did you feel that? Was there a process of going, I need to remove myself from this and look at Eddie as a character rather than a representation of myself? Did you allow yourself to put yourself into the book?
Yeah, because you know, I don't like Eddie.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't like me.
Why is that?
Because Eddie was not a different child. Other people would tell him, you are different, you know, like people often do. Mm. You are different. Look at you. You are nigger. You are faggot. You are all these words that build our identities. We don't choose it. You arrive in the world. You didn't ask anything. And suddenly you have a name that you didn't choose. Mm. It can be Eddie. It can be faggot. It can be nigger. But you have these names that takes you and shape you and will decide your whole future. But all these people, they were telling me that I was different, but I didn't feel different. I didn't understand why. I just had a desire for boys and not for girls, but it didn't make me feel that different, you know? And so Eddie was like his parents. He would say that Arabs were dangerous. He was homophobic. You can be gay and homophobic. You can be Jewish and anti-Semitic. And I really had to take a step back in order to be, because I couldn't be in the mind of Eddie because of precisely I don't like Eddie. Mm. So I had to take this distance. And plus, most of time, like in the past, let's say 60 years to be ambitious, when people were talking about like poor people or working class, even if my book is not about working class, but like post-industrial, they always like felt obliged to present the poor people are more authentic, better. So it, like all these works were full of love, you know, the works of Jean Genet, the works of Pasolini, the works of Ken Loach, there were all these people that want to show that the poor people are brave, that they are living the real life, you know, when the bourgeoisie is full of hypocrisy, of lies, of roles. I don't have any problems with roles, you know. I did drama for 5 years and I'm okay with roles. So, but it's kind of considered as a bad thing. And I didn't want to fit in this kind of discourse, you know. Mm. I wanted to show that I can fight for my mother. When I look at the conditions of like of life of my mother, it makes me crazy. I want to fight against it. But that doesn't mean that I have to love her, you know. You don't have to mix love and politics. You can fight for a group, you can fight for a class, you can fight for a category of people without telling that they are fantastic, you know. Because it's like, it's a trap from capitalism, it's a trap from meritocracy, you know? You have to prove that people merit to be fight for. They have to merit that you struggle for them. But for me, that's precisely what the system expects, and I didn't want it. I want to say, I can fight for prisoners. That doesn't mean that I want to have a dinner with prisoners every night, because they are probably not very pro-women, not very pro-gays. I know, because a lot of people in my family went to jail. So that when you call it self-pity, that not self-pity, not having self-pity, not having like, not being cheesy or this milieu, that's what I wanted. I wanted to reinvestigate this relationship between love and politics, and to be as fair as possible, and so to take a step back from this kind of ideology.
So much of the book is about masculinity and the balance between what could be called true behavior and what is a sort of inherited performative kind of masculinity. In the UK, we'd call it laddish behaviour. There's a scene where Eddie stands in the bathroom and talks about reciting. Every morning in the bathroom getting ready, I would repeat the same phrase to myself over and over again so many times that it ceased making any sense, becoming nothing but a series of syllables of sounds. Then I'd stop and start over again. Today I'm going to be a tough guy. I remember it because I would always repeat exactly the same sentence in the same way you repeat a prayer, in the same words, the same exact words. Today I'm going to be a tough guy. And now I'm crying as I write these lines. I'm crying because I find that sentence hideous and ridiculous, that sentence that went everywhere with me for several years and was, I don't think I'm exaggerating, at the center of my being. Now, you talk about that in the past tense. Have you been able to, I mean, masculinity is so tangible in this book, and you look at parts of it that are really toxic, but you have got a separation here now where you can look back on it. Mm-hmm. Have you had conversations with your family at all, with your father, for example?
Yeah, I did. And what I can tell is that, like, nothing really changed. And this, like, terrible thing about masculinity is still going on and on, even if everybody failed, you know. Like, Eddie was the champion of the losers. He was the master loser. But all the other people, they were all failing. Even my father, when you read the end of Eddie, you can see that my father is telling, oh, a man doesn't cry, a man never cry. And my father is always crying. And I don't think my mother is crying a single time in the book, because she wouldn't cry that much when I was little. And my father, each time he was drinking, he was crying and saying that he was sorry for what he was, and he was sorry for what we endured, and he was sorry about our poverty, as if it was his fault, you know, mm-hmm. and not the fault of the system. But he was crying again and again like this. And what struck me when I was writing the book is to see that the norms, and for example, the norm of masculinity, are so tough, even if at the same time nobody succeeds in achieving these norms, in performing these norms. So there is kind of a gap between the norms and the life of the people. And that's why the norms are so violent. You know, the norms are not violent because they force you to have a certain behavior. The norms are violent because they put you into shame. They put shame on you because you never succeed. Because no matter how the body react, no matter how people behave, the norms still go on. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. We have 2,000 years of history of masculinity, even more, and 2,000 years or even more of failure. And this norm still exists. How is it possible? How the discourse, how the ideology, how the norms can be that powerful? It's crazy. Mm-hmm. And so everybody in my family was ashamed because they never succeeded. And Eddie more than the others, but all of them at the end.
And this book came out in 2014 in France.
Yeah.
And you were 21.
Something like this.
Yeah. That's like so unbelievably young. And it was a huge success in France. I think it sold something like 300,000 copies, which is quite remarkable. How do you...
Not only in France.
Not only in France, exactly. It's been translated into 20 languages, I think, which is quite amazing.
I'm kidding.
I mean, well, how do you deal with that success? Especially because, I mean, you're 24 now.
No, I don't know. Like, because success is a big world, you know? And so if you have a big success with your first book, as, I don't know, as Céline did, or as, I don't know, the writers did. It's not the same thing that being successful, like Beyoncé, you know. And they are very different kinds of things. And no, I don't know what to say. I was just so moved because I received like thousands and thousands and thousands of emails, letters, Facebook messages of people telling me, I recognize my life, I recognize my story, or I am happy that finally someone is talking another way about poor people, like being empathic but fair at the same time, and talking about the violence that exists in the working class because of the violence they suffer from, but still at the end it exists. If you are a woman, if you're gay, if you're a person of color, then you suffer, you know? And so that was the moving thing, that the only thing I remember from that success is all these people writing to me, because it was one of the biggest subject of the book, one of the main subjects. It was this violence that takes you when you are born, you know, and that defines you, and that you are born in violence. You are born with this word that takes you, like the poor Jewish or everything we were talking about before. And all your life, you more or less fight against this violence. And this is the story of so many people. And where is it in literature? In most literature, in 95% of literature, it's people going to psychotherapy, people, I don't know, people dealing with a little problem. People need literature that reflects their life. That's fair. I don't want to read a literature that doesn't reflect the world I live in, you know.
And the French, there was some cases of French journalists going to your hometown and trying to find members of your family and members of the town to quote them in stories about, I think, trying to determine what was fact and what was not. How did you deal with that? Because that's obviously that's a hugely intrusive thing to have to deal with.
So intrusive and so violent. I hated it. And some people did it from other country, you know. El País in Spain did it. Some newspaper from Norway, from Germany. I hated this bourgeois journalist going to a safari to see the poor people, you know. It killed me. It literally made me so angry, you know. And, you know, as though violence was something so easy. I mean, what was they expecting? They were expecting to see like crucified gays in the street, or people demonstrating for Marine Le Pen in the street of the 900 person village. That doesn't make any sense. You know, violence is so much more complicated. Violence is so much more subtle, you know? And that's why I needed 2 years and a half to write this book, because it's not that easy. And if you go to see someone, and if you ask someone, do you suffer? The person will say no, you know, because people don't want to be considered as victims. They are afraid of it. I am afraid of it. I was afraid to write The End of Eddie because I didn't want people to perceive me as a victim. And that's one of the biggest problem when you deal with politics. is that people who suffer don't want to say that they suffer. So then how do you do to fix the world? How can you do? If you see my mother and if you ask her, in the end of it, she keeps saying it. She's saying, oh, you know, she has this extremely like difficult life as a woman of a poor milieu. My father didn't want my mother to work. She wanted to work, but he didn't want because he said, no, a mother has to stay at home and everything. But when she was talking about herself, she would say, oh, but I can't complain. You know, my life could be worse. But no, just complain. Do it. There is nothing more beautiful than complaining, you know? Do it. And because it's the first gesture for the revolution, you know? Mm-hmm. Karl Marx would say that the shame and the complaining is the first gesture of the lion before the lion jumps, you know? And so, of course, these journalists, if they go to the village, my mother will say, no, I'm very happy, you know? Mm. And so that was, of course, like completely ridiculous. Mm. It didn't make any sense. And that was, I didn't name the village in my book. I changed the name of my family. You know, I protected them. And the journalists went there and were inventing fiction when I was dealing with truth in my novel. Mm. That was funny.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Well, loads of interesting issues there, which we thought would be worth teasing out a bit. So after the interview, Sian, Richard Lee and I met up for a chat about the history of autofiction and why some readers feel so uneasy about that blurred line between what is true and what isn't.
The interesting thing about Edouard Louis is that he is French and he comes from a country that has a long tradition of autofiction. But even in his own country, as you will have heard in the interview, that he had a lot of backlash from the media who were sort of tracking down members of his family and questioning locals in the town and trying to determine what was real and what wasn't. And as he says, he found that really invasive and quite a horrible process to go through because he's really young and he had to deal with all that sort of attention from national press. And I think that all stems from that idea that we're just very uncomfortable sometimes when it's not 100% clear to us what is true and what isn't.
But that's France. So this is true of France, this uncomfortableness, well, as well as
that's the strange
Anglophone
thing, because
cultures.
I don't think it traditionally has been. It's quite strange that this has happened to Edouard. And I wonder whether this comes down to his background and class, and he sort of brings that up, that that was possibly a factor in why the locals in his town were questioned so much. But it's very strange because if France has been famously okay with this. Like, I read a thing about Nausgaard and the Norwegian writer, and he has written all these autobiographical works that were massive successes sort of in England and all around the world, but not in France. And apparently it was because the French were just like, well, this is completely normal. We've been doing this for ages. We don't really care. This is not a novelty to us. And so they didn't uphold it as a sort of strange new world, as we sort of did.
So Richard, I'm going to bring you in here now, because you, as a francophone...
Or a francophile, let's say.
A francophile.
The phone is wearing off, but the file is still there.
Yeah, and you've read a lot of French literature. Tell us a little bit about this autofiction tradition.
Well, I guess it goes all the way back to Proust, really, in the end, who created this kind of imaginary world about this guy who was kind of a bit like him, really. But, I mean, Serge Dubrovsky was the guy who coined the phrase autofiction, referring to his novel Feasts, which was published in 1977. But there's Marguerite Duras, there's Annie Ernaux, Camille Laurence, Emmanuel Carrère. There's a whole string of them who are walking this line between, is this really something that happened to me? Is this something that happened around me? Or, in fact, have I just made it up? And they get a lot of play from that, a lot of ability. It also gets them into a bunch of trouble. I mean, Emmanuel Carrère himself fell out with both his mother and his lover over his memoir, a Russian novel. Of course, there you have it right there. It was called Un roman russe, and is translated into English as a Russian novel, but it's not really actually a work of fiction as we would understand it in the Anglophone culture. It's a work of memoir, really.
I'm going to bring you back to Proust, because I got into a bit of trouble. I wrote a piece about Proust a little while ago, and I was talking about Swan, and it came up whether Swan was Proust to some extent. And there is the question, because actually Proust is the narrator who talks about Swann. You know.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, the character of Proust would be the narrator, not Swann.
Yes, very
much so. But, yes. I mean,
although Swann is also quite similar to Proust in a way, in that he's a sort of bourgeois character trying to make his way in the world, isn't he?
Absolutely. And the character of the narrator in the novel is part of this very highfalutin world in a way that Proust kind of wasn't. It's a fascinating little tiny video emerged of Proust walking down the steps of a cathedral after a society wedding at the beginning of the last century. Just emerged just recently, a piece of archive footage where you see all these guys in top hats with their massive frocks, and then there's this little guy who looks like a sort of bank worker with a little bowler hat walks down among them. That's him, or supposedly that's him. And in fact, so this fictional creation was, of course, a distance from him, but nevertheless, it feels like it's entire life in this massive work.
So do we think that this novel, End of Eddie, is actually going to be read as it was intended to be read, that it is going to work in the UK?
I hope so. I mean, Edouard talks about, with that book, that the only reason he decided to write it as a sort of fiction was he needed to distance himself from it. And it's completely understandable when you're reading it, because he had a really hard childhood. And there's not even that much distance between himself. Like, his name's Edouard, the boy's name is Eddie. That's what his family called him when he was a kid. And it just allowed him distance to write about something that was very, very personal in a nuanced way. You know, it gave him a certain amount of detachment, which I think is needed when it's very emotional and also very personal to you.
What is the difference between this and Nausgaard, My Struggle, his 6 books of fiction, he says?
That's the thing. I mean, because with Eddie, he's kept a lot of things very, very true and very, very similar, and even the region of France where he's from is the same as in the book. With Nausgaard, he changed names, but then that didn't even really work because his uncle got very annoyed with him, and so did his ex-wife, because it was very immediately apparent to everyone around them which characters they were. So I don't really know whether there is a distinction, I suppose.
Maybe one of the problems here is just a question of terminology. I mean, in France, you've got the word roman, and in English, you've got the word novel, and they don't really describe the same thing. If you look at the dictionary definition of roman in Larousse, it's a work of the imagination, they call it, which is to say it's kind of something in which the imagination is used to transform the story, for sure. But if you look at Collins' definition of novel in English, they say it's a work of prose about imaginary characters, and the distinction is quite subtle, but it's really there. And so maybe the part of the problem is that as Anglophone readers, we're trying to draw a dividing line where none really exists.
So where do we put in this, say, Philip Roth? You know, who I Married a Communist, everybody knew was about his marriage to Claire Bloom. But is it also then in his later novels, he is both Philip Roth, occasionally self-naming, and he is Nathan Zuckerman, who is a biographical, ongoing picture of Philip Roth, isn't he?
I was really struggling with postmodern cleverness and all this. Every time I see an author put themselves in their book, I get really irritated. And I don't know why. I think it's very self-indulgent. And I think that if you want to write about yourself, I think there's absolutely scope to do that. But just, you know, like Bret Easton Ellis putting Bret Easton Ellis into books just really.
Yeah, but that was a moment, wasn't it? With people like Bret Easton Ellis and Jonathan Safran Foer. That's a sort of postmodern brat.
See, with Jonathan Safran Foer, I kind of keep him distinct, because with Everything is Illuminated, like, that was sort of drawn upon a thesis that he wrote about his own personal family history. So having him there as a sort of little observer that doesn't actually say very much, that sort of just tags along and is observed through someone else's eyes, I kind of liked that. But Bret Easton Ellis turning up in stuff and making sassy comments about Hollywood and the emptiness of LA and all this sort of stuff, it's kind of almost just like he's put himself in there to go, aren't I clever? Like, it's not just the book that's clever. I'm in the book and I'm saying clever things. And I kind of lump Philip Roth in that with that as well. Like, I don't mind the whole having Nathan Zuckerman to explore himself and stuff, but then having Philip Roth appear in like The Plot Against America and what was that book that he wrote? Operation Shylock, where Philip Roth finds out that there is a person called Philip Roth that is doing something in Israel. And I'm so tired of that. It just feels like a vanity.
But is it not always the thing that we come back to with books is that if it's well done, it's great. And if it's not, if it doesn't convince us for whatever reason, then it's not.
That's a very easy thing to say.
Philip Roth is great. Like, I love Philip Roth, but that just feels like such an empty rubbish. It's pointless to me. Why would he do that?
I mean, there's another point, isn't there? This point that you touched on with that definition of what fiction is, what a novel is in a dictionary definition, which is imaginary, that we somehow give priority to the idea of something that is created out of the imagination. But actually, it's very... Everything a novelist writes has been observed by them, has been filtered through their brain with their experiences. But it's in a way, it is it just a question of whether it's good or not good?
I guess for me, that I have trouble with books where the effect, in some sense, depends on other information that the reader brings to the novel. So the novel only works if you know that actually this bit of it is true or that bit of it is true. And it seems to me that that isn't playing the game of fiction at some level.
But does that actually ever happen? I don't think I can think of an autobiographical novel where you needed to know. You don't need to know that it's true.
No.
That Nausgaard's father was an alcoholic or whatever.
Yeah, I think some people will always want to know. But I think that the success is when you go, I don't need to know. That I can take this. Like Chris Krauss, who wrote I Love Dick, she said something very interesting where she said, like, absolutely, all of this happened, and there are a lot of legal issues about what I'm writing because there is an individual involved that I'm writing some very personal things about. But instead of taking this as a memoir, because I don't want it to be a memoir, because there's so much of female writing is dismissed as confessional and personal and stuff, I want people to read this like a fable and to read this as a sort of general tale to teach them something about the world. And that's great. Like, you know, you can actually get that from reading I Love Dick without hearing her say it. And I think the best books do operate like that. Like, at the end of Eddie, it very much operates as a sort of wider look at the power of abuse and homophobia and a struggle very early on in your life. What happens to you later on? You don't need to know whether it's true or not. It just so happens that it is. And we've got an author that's willing to say that it is. I mean, you have cases like Ferrante as well, Elena Ferrante, where we don't know anything about
her. We have
her.
No idea whether it's autobiographical. Yeah. It's just that the framing of it is almost as if it was autobiographical, but that may well be just a fictional device.
Yes, absolutely.
And her publishers always picks people up on that. She says, this is a novel. Yeah. You don't know what Elena Ferrante's life is.
Exactly. And then there's all these criticisms that she's actually responded to where people are saying, you know, like when that journalist, the Italian journalist, tried to expose who she was and her identity, he was claiming that he was doing it for an ethical reason because she had just published an autobiographical work, which was mainly composed of letters between herself and her editor, saying that there were lies in there. But he doesn't know who she is. And he was saying that there were lies based on who he thought she was. And so he's saying, oh, there's an ethical obligation. She's presenting this as fact. But all of this stems from the success of her fiction, which doesn't need to be true. And I think she's often responded to this, the criticism that too often women get accused when they write something that's as epic as that quartet is, that the personal is political, that she must be basing these sort of great political sagas that come through her book, they must be based on something that happened to her because she couldn't have the imagination to write it. So she gets really, really angry when people say that this is autobiographical, because maybe it is, but it's too often dismissive.
Isn't it also partly to do, it's partly a marketing thing, isn't it? I mean, we're obsessed with biography and with true life stories. I went to the cinema the other day to see Lion, and I was really struck by the fact that all the trailers were saying this is based on a true story. Every single trailer for every single film that I was about to see, it's somehow as if that authenticates fiction for us today.
It's almost a devaluing in the art of the imagination, that if you make it up, it's not enough anymore.
Yeah.
And you get authors who resist that kind of temptation to justify themselves by what they've taken from their lives and who say, no, I just made it up.
I've got a controversial opinion.
Go on then, yeah. Shock us with it.
I think if James Frey wrote a Million Little Pieces today, as opposed to 10 years ago, it would have been a huge success and it would have worked. And he wouldn't have been pulled up on Oprah and yelled at and criticised for making things up in this memoir that he presented.
How much of the book is fabricated? What was true about the dentist? Why do you have to lie about that?
I've struggled with the idea of it and...
No, the lie of it. That's a lie. It's not an idea, James, it's a lie.
Because he originally wrote it as a novel and he shopped it around and no one was interested, including Random House, who eventually published it. So he rejigged it as a memoir. And of course, in this whole rewriting process, there's that very interesting phenomena that happens where people start recreating their own memories, where they start rejigging it a bit. And he said later on that he actually isn't entirely sure whether bits aren't true, because he might have, in the process of rewriting it, completely changed his own memory of certain events. And when it was shopped around as a memoir, it was a huge success. And then, of course, it had this very public downfall where people started looking into his criminal history, because that was very easy to track, and saying, well, you know, he wasn't in jail for 80 days. He was in jail for a couple of hours once and stuff like that. And I absolutely think that if he'd written it now, there would have been the flexibility to present it as a novel and a memoir. And this would not be... it would not have been a problem.
So you're saying the culture has actually shifted?
I think the culture has shifted, because all of his defence for things that happened in that book, there were certain things like, oh, he changed the manner in which one very major character suicided. And I remember Oprah calling him out on TV going, oh, well, was that to make it more dramatic? And he was like, no, I have to disguise certain things. This is a real person with a real family. And it was kind of treated as if he was hiding the truth from people, where he's going, I know I've got an obligation as a writer to hide certain things from readers.
Perhaps we've got more sophisticated about our reading of memoir as it is anyway, because, I mean, the idea that you can remember a conversation you had with someone 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, the idea that memoir itself is in some sense true, that it's not made up, is slightly suspect as well.
Yeah, that's another whole area of discussion, isn't it? I mean, this is sort of just seems to me this is sort of actually key to how our culture is at the moment, and it relates to so many other areas of personal revelation, of, you know, the wannabe culture, of all sorts of things, which we will go on and no doubt discuss many other times. But thank you very much.
Edouard Louis' The End of Eddie is published by Harville Secker and is out now. Next week's interviewee is the philosopher Daniel Dennett, who discusses how the mind has evolved.
And we'll be back around the table chatting about everything we've been up to in the week. This will include the 40th anniversary of the comic book 2000 AD, the centenary of Anthony Burgess, and anything else that takes our fancy.
So join us then. For more literary interviews, discussions and live events, search on Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or by swiping or tapping on your smartphone. Just open up your favourite podcast app. And you can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. From me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian, who's sitting underneath her headphones in the corner. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks to you. Thanks for your interview.
Thank you.
No. I think it was one of the best interviews of my life. I promise, because I just
really?
Felt so good,
oh, good
with you. No, frankly,
it was the
promise
espresso.
It. You can.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.